This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Eric Duplass, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Eric spearheads Sightline's work on climate and energy policy. He blogs for the Sightline series, The Northwest Pipeline on Rails and the Risk of Northwest Oil Spills. And his recent reports for Sightline include Northwest Fossil Fuel Exports and the facts about Kinder Morgan. Eric Duplass is here today to tell us about the implications of oil transport by rail in the Pacific Northwest. Welcome, Eric.
Well, thank you for having me.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about Sightline Institute?
Sure. We're a sustainability research institute, and we work in British Columbia, Oregon, and Washington on a range of issues. Recently, the most interesting issue to me has been this sea change in the way in which we transport and consume energy in the Pacific Northwest, because it's one that I think tells a very broad story about global energy dynamics and about the future, really, of the planet.
Before we focus in on oil, would you give an overview of all fossil fuel transport in the Northwest and the implications for carbon emissions?
Sure. What most people don't realize is that the last few years, really since about 2012, we have embarked on a complete departure from the way in which this region has thought about and used energy. And what's happened, if you look at projects that have been either newly built or proposed since 2012, you can come up with about a dozen coal terminals. You can come up with about a dozen oil-by-rail terminals, two major oil pipelines, both in Canada, and then about six natural gas pipelines. It depends how you do the counting. That's just the big stuff. Those proposals basically stretch along this sliver of coast from Prince Rupert, British Columbia to Coos Bay, Oregon. Many of them are concentrated in Washington State. And in aggregate, they add up to an absolutely enormous amount of fossil fuel energy, of carbon-based energy that is now scheduled for export. So at the highest level, one way to think about this is in reference to the Keystone XL pipeline. Many folks have heard about Keystone XL. They know it's a signature issue for Obama. What they don't realize, maybe, is that while that is a very, very big issue, what's on the table in the Northwest right now is the carbon equivalent of about five and a half times the size of Keystone XL. So that's a hugely consequential energy question and decision that this region, the Pacific Northwest, will make, and you know, North America at large. But it's concentrated in a very small area and really, in actuality, dwarfs the impact of Keystone.
Now let's look at oil. How much oil is moving through the Northwest at present?
So right now, the Pacific Northwest refines about 650,000 barrels per day of crude oil. That's principally through five major refineries on Puget Sound, and then there's some refined product pipelines elsewhere. What's scheduled for the Northwest, what's new going forward, is this enormous growth in oil-by-rail proposals. Those are proposals that we've seen in other parts of the country as well. It's a particularly big deal, again, in the same region. It observes the same sort of geographic dynamic, which is that you've got these big fossil fuel reserves in the middle of the country. They're far from markets. And then on the opposite side of the Pacific, you've got the hungriest and most dynamic energy markets in the world in Asia. And squeezed between those two points is this little sliver of coast that stands to receive far more oil than it could possibly refine, far more oil than it could possibly use. And so you're looking at 800,000, maybe a million barrels of new oil per day coming in by train. That's on top of new pipelines that are planned for British Columbia. That's on top of other changes to the energy markets.
Would you say more about where the oil moving through the Northwest comes from?
Sure. So again, this is all part of the revolution in energy production in this country. It's an interesting story. Most of the oil coming to the Pacific Northwest now, there's sort of two ways to think about this. The stuff that's scheduled for delivery in the immediate future is from the Bakken Formation, which is a big shale oil play in North Dakota and some surrounding areas. And that oil is basically a very light oil. It's deep underground. It's extracted by fracking and some advanced drilling techniques. It's light, it's volatile, it's potentially explosive, and it's being put on trains and moved to the coasts now. Going forward, if we think about a longer time horizon, it is very likely that the heavy Canadian oil, sometimes called the tar sands oil from Alberta, would also be moved by train or by pipeline to the Northwest coast.
Would you also say more about where the oil moving through the Northwest goes and who is using it?
Right now, most of what's happening is that the oil is coming to the Northwest, being refined and consumed domestically. Some of it is being shipped down to California. Some of it is refined and then shipped overseas. But what we are seeing now at the federal level, and this is an issue that should concern everyone in North America, is that the Obama administration is beginning to erode and loophole a 40-year ban on crude oil exports. If that ban gets lifted, which is what the oil industry wants, if the ban even gets eroded more than it's already been eroded, we can very much imagine a scenario in which places like the Northwest and a few other places too, the Gulf Coast, could become basically a way station on an oil highway of domestic crude or Canadian crude, which is already exempt from the ban, to foreign markets. So you can imagine, and this doesn't take really a lot of hypothesis, you can imagine that Puget Sound becomes a major, major oil depot for U.S. crude that's bound for China. That's a very real future.
Right now, how much of the oil moving through the Northwest is being carried by train versus pipeline?
That's a good question. Most of the crude oil that arrives at the Puget Sound refineries is coming by tanker vessel from the North Slope of Alaska and from a few other locations. Some of it comes down from a pipeline in British Columbia. What we've seen now is this radical scale up in oil delivered by train. So that probably right now, it's hard to say exactly, but we're probably seeing as much oil delivered by train as by pipeline. The interesting thing is that both of those industries, for somewhat different dynamics, have large expansion proposals in the works. So two major oil pipelines in British Columbia are scheduled or proposed for build out. Some of that oil would serve or could theoretically serve the Northwest, although we're already swimming in crude oil we can't refine. And at the same time, we're looking at massive expansions in oil deliveries to port terminals at Grays Harbor, the Columbia River, and Puget Sound, again, over and above what we already have. So on some level, it's hard to know where all that oil is ultimately bound. We couldn't possibly refine and consume it all, even if we tripled our consumption. So it's not for us. It's for California, or it's more likely for markets abroad, probably on the opposite side of the Pacific.
Where does the decision about transporting oil through the Northwest and how it is regulated lie? Who is in control?
Right now, most of the regulatory authority for oil spill prevention and cleanup and for management falls within the purview of state agencies, particularly the State Department of Ecology. That is an agency that has done, I think it's fair to say, a very good job with protecting us from catastrophic spills. But it's certainly not bulletproof. And even under business as usual, there's every possibility that this region could experience an oil spill catastrophe or an oil spill explosion like we've seen from trains in other parts of the country. And those can be fatal. In fact, have been fatal. Going forward, you know, if we're looking at doubling or tripling the amount of crude oil that moves through this region, it is my judgment that our current systems are not even close to being equipped to deal with that level and that dispersal of risk all around the region. It's a way of transporting oil, trains are, and types of oil and volumes of oil that just have no precedence in this region. They're completely out of scale with what we've seen in the past. And that's something that I would like to see state and federal decision makers acknowledge more clearly, that what the future could look like for this region doesn't look anything like what the past has looked like. It could be a radical departure, and we need to plan for that contingency. I hope that that contingency doesn't come to play, but it very well could if the industry gets its way.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Our topic is the implications of oil transport by rail in the Pacific Northwest. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you say a few words about the implication for Northwest communities along the oil train routes?
Right. There's been a lot of discussion recently about just what oil trains mean and how dangerous they are. And it's my judgment that they're quite a serious danger. And what we've seen since about 2012, that was the first time a quote-unquote unit oil train arrived in Washington State. Those are the long 100-plus car oil trains. You can see them on the waterfront quite often and other places as well. Those oil trains are typically loaded with Bakken oil. It's a combustible, volatile fuel. And when they have derailed, some of those trains have erupted in fireballs that are so cinematic, you almost can't believe it's real. You can go to YouTube and Google oil train explosion, and what you'll see are, you know, they look like they're out of a James Cameron movie or something like that. It's astonishing. In one case, an oil train derailed and killed 47 people in a small town in Quebec and literally incinerated masonry buildings all throughout the downtown core. I mean, melted them down to the ground. Those trains are running through downtown Seattle on a daily basis. They're running through communities all through eastern Washington, along the Columbia River, and along the shores of Puget Sound. We are not adequately prepared to deal with an oil train fire or explosion. That's something that first responders would say quite clearly, fire departments will say quite clearly. We don't have the capacity. We can't put those fires out. You have to evacuate them. I don't know how you evacuate a half mile of the downtown Seattle core when the industry insists on running a loaded oil train through the waterfront during Seafair weekend or past the Mariners Stadium during the ninth inning of the game. That really happens, and it's really dangerous.
What are the implications of oil transport for Northwest waterways?
And that's the sort of second and less sort of drastic, but also very important feature. So historically, the danger of oil spills, we have typically thought of as being a tanker vessel that's coming down from Alaska or moving through Puget Sound, and we have plans in place to manage that. Moving large quantities of oil by rail raises this whole other question about how you plan for and mitigate and prepare yourself to deal with oil spills, much to say nothing of the explosions, but oil spills that are dispersed all along the regional rail network. So you can have oil spills into the Columbia River, into eastern Washington farmland, in a downtown. We have seen now at least one, and probably more like 6 to 8 cases, although the information is not being shared well publicly, where an oil train has had a valve broken on the bottom of it and has then leaked substantial quantities of crude oil all along the rail route. Where is that oil going? In some cases, in a very notable case in Minnesota, I mean, it leaked large quantities of oil all throughout the state. There aren't cleanup plans in place to deal with that. And in Washington now, we've seen several oil trains, again, with cracked or broken valves in the bottom, that have apparently now distributed oil across the rail lines. And the public doesn't know where those spills have happened. We don't have plans in place to deal with it now. It's a real problem.
To what extent have oil spills been a problem in the Northwest historically?
Well, more than people realize. So one of the things that Sightline has been doing over the last few weeks and few months has been sort of going back through the record and cataloging the biggest oil spills that we've had, and also looking, incidentally, at near misses, places where things almost went catastrophically wrong, but didn't, and not because our plans intervened, but just because we got lucky. And what you find if you go back and look at the historical record is that we haven't had an Exxon Valdez here, but we've had some pretty nasty ones, both in the Columbia River, the Outer Coast, and in the Sound. And it's my judgment that if we look at the historical record, and you know, the most recent sort of big deal one was one called the Dalco Pass spill, which happened in the South Sound near Vashon Island. But there have been plenty of others, including some that did a lot of damage to wildlife and waterways. It's my judgment that if you look at that history, the history shows, I think, that oil spills are a built-in risk. They're a feature, not a bug, of moving large quantities of oil. And if we're going to double or triple the amount of oil that we move around, ship through this region, we're going to dial up the risk proportionally or maybe sort of out of proportion. And to the extent that oil spills are unacceptable now, and I think they are, what are we thinking about what the future could hold?
Would you say more about where the risks of oil spills come from?
Yeah, I mean, most people think, and I think appropriately so, that the biggest risk is from a loaded, you know, tanker vessel or tank barge carrying crude oil, refined product. And the issue of, like, the Exxon Valdez is a great example where you have a loaded tanker vessel, the hull gets punctured and spills all kinds of oil. That's real, it's a real danger, and it could be catastrophic. In addition to that, though, you get increases in oil spill risk by moving any number of large vessels around. So even a loaded, let's say, a coal bulk carrier, which could be serving the coal export terminals that the fossil fuel industry has planned, those carry huge quantities of what's called bunker fuel. It's a heavy, nasty fuel oil. Those have leaked in the past. Those kinds of vessels have leaked many times in the past. They can be damaged and leaked. And then, of course, for all the cargo vessels that we have planned around the region or we use now, those vessels have to be fueled and refueled. They have to be loaded with bunker fuel. Sometimes fuel comes on and off. And all of that movement of oil and petroleum product raises the risk. And as we have more vessels in narrow, challenging sea lanes, all of those risks get increased.
How much of an increase in risk of oil spills are we likely to see if the proposed refinery and shipment expansions take place?
That's a great question. And so it's a question that seems like there would be a straightforward answer. I mean, the straightforward answer is it will increase by some to a lot. The actual particulars of it depend a lot on whether and how these facilities get built and which area we're talking about. The most robust sort of analytical look at increased risk would say that in some places, the South Sound, for example, the risk gets worse, but not a lot worse. In other places, the San Juan Islands being a great example of this, or the outer part of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, the risk could triple. I mean, it could go way, way up. That is both the risk of a collision that spills oil or the sort of probabilistic estimate of how much oil might get dispersed into the environment could increase by hundreds of percents. That, I think, raises a real question for us about how do we protect places that we care about, like the San Juan Islands, which are, of course, not just recreationally beautiful, but home to an enormous number of wildlife species, including orcas, that we would, I think, like to have continue in this region. And, you know, again, like the Strait of Juan de Fuca is a potentially very challenging environment in a world where we increase oil transport by large quantities. You can put salmon runs at risk, you can put shorebirds at risk, seabirds at risk, and of course you can do substantial damage to the economy too. A lot of Washington's economy, whether it's maritime trade or recreation or what have you, depends on a clean and healthy environment, And that's something that the oil industry is perfectly willing to sacrifice for its profits.
Well, you've alluded a bit to this already, but what are the implications of oil spills for human safety and public health?
It can be profound. I mean, we have seen examples where the heavy Canadian tar sands oil has spilled in other parts of the country. There's a very notable case in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where a pipeline rupture put large volumes of heavy Canadian oil into the Kalamazoo River. And there were probably fairly serious human health effects from just being near that stuff. It's very nasty. It's toxic. There are lighter hydrocarbons and vapors that are connected to it, all of which have potentially problematic health effects. Of course, you know, if it's Bakken oil or something like that, if it's a light oil and it spills and blows up, then you can just be incinerated. And that's death by fireball is probably the most obvious health risk. But there are a whole other range of health risks that come from that, including contaminating fish and shellfish and so on. So it really depends on the nature and context for those spills. But I think it's fair to say that people in the Northwest and everywhere, really, I mean, they value clean, swimmable beaches. They value having fish that you can eat and birds and orca whales and all the rest of it. And I don't think we should minimize that. That's part of who we are. That's part of what we care about.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric Duplass, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Our topic is the implications of oil transport by rail in the Pacific Northwest. Why don't we already have adequate safety for oil transport?
Well, the Department of Ecology, I think, has done a good job on the maritime side with the way the system has worked for the last many decades. And that's not to say that it's perfect. It's not, and it should be improved because the historical record shows there have been oil spills. What we are not prepared for, though, is the way it's changing, the way we're looking at massive pipeline expansions in Canada and the way we're looking at massive oil train expansions in Washington and Oregon and many other places around the country, too. And the reason is that this stuff is new, and so we're not experienced with it. It's not something we're accustomed to, and we don't have the plans in place. We don't have the funding in place. In many cases, we don't even have basic information. The railroads operate in some kind of regulatory black box where they can basically tell state decision makers and state officials and certainly local officials that, you know, it's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. We're not going to tell you anything about it. We're not going to tell you when the trains run. We're not going to tell you what's on the trains. We might try to not tell you when we have an accident. There's pretty good evidence that they have had accidents involving hazardous substances, involving crude oil, where it looks like, to me, they've gone to lengths to try to avoid the public finding out about it, to even avoid having emergency responders find out about it. We had an oil train derail very near downtown Seattle. Thank God nothing happened. It derailed at about 4 or 5 miles an hour. And they somehow just kind of neglected to ever tell the fire department until a nearby business owner saw a derailed oil train and then called 911 about 4 or 5 hours later. That raises real questions to me about whether we can trust the rail industry to handle 800,000 barrels of crude oil per day pointed to Washington State. They have federal exemptions that make them basically immune to our laws and process. That's a problem.
What are the most effective safety steps that can be taken to mitigate the risk of oil spills?
The most effective safety step is to transition away from using huge quantities of crude oil and to avoid becoming a way station for massive crude exports to China and other places on the other side of the Pacific. Ultimately, you can mitigate this stuff, but you can't prevent the risk. And so what we need to do is something we're already taking the early steps of doing, which is transitioning toward a cleaner energy economy that's not based on dangerous and hazardous fossil fuels. That's the path we need to be on over the long term. Over the short term, we should be demanding that the industry share a lot more information. We need to know where this product is moving, when it's moving, what's the nature of it. We need to require them to develop adequate funding mechanisms, that is a tax or fee or something, on every barrel of crude oil that moves through the state so that we can put in place real robust contingency plans to clean up oil spills when they happen, because they will happen. And also fund our emergency responders so that we can have evacuation plans and figure out some way to not have large-scale fatalities if we have, God forbid, another oil train explode in an urban area. And also, I would say one more thing that's super important. You know, the oil trains are, for the most part, so radically underinsured that they're effectively uninsured. We should require them to carry insurance that's proportional to the risk. The federal government estimates an oil train derailment in an urban area could be in the $5 billion range. And railroad typically has $1 billion or $1.5 billion in insurance. That's just not right from a market perspective.
What most stands in the way of implementing steps to improve safety?
What stands in the way is the industry is intractable. And, you know, I don't mean to make them sound like sort of super bad guys, but in many senses, they are sort of super bad guys. And it's basically the railroad industry and the pipeline industry and the oil industry working in collaboration or collusion to prevent state, local, and federal lawmakers from enacting the sort of safety regulations that the public thinks are already in place. The public would say it's just common sense. And so we're at a place now where if the public says, look, we think you should carry insurance proportional to the risk, they'll say, no, you can't make us because we're preempted with federal rules. And by the way, we've sort of locked down the federal regulatory agencies too. If we say, well, look, you shouldn't ship volatile crude oil in tank cars that federal safety inspectors have known are unsafe for 20 years, they'll say, well, no, you can't make us. What we'll do is we'll make you some non-binding voluntary assurances, and again, we'll lock down the federal regulators. And so on this whole range of issues, you find that the industry has been extremely effective in preventing the sort of modest, incremental, common sense solutions to sorting this stuff out that you would think would be in place by now.
Where did the most effective leverage points lie in addressing oil transport safety?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. The most effective leverage points right now are us. There's this very curious thing that's going on where the Northwest, because it is in this particular spot between the fossil reserves and Asia, we will ultimately decide whether we're going to build these oil train depots and these port terminals and allow refineries to have more oil trains. If we say no to those things, if we say no, we don't want that stuff here, it's not for us, it's too dangerous, it's bad for the climate, and on and on and on, then the oil trains don't run. And that solves a safety problem right there with a bullet. Now, in as much as they are running or will continue to run in the future, then the leverage is really at the federal level. And it's with, unfortunately, a federal agency that has not, with a sub-agency of the U.S. Department of Transportation, that has not been real receptive to public opinion. But in that case, it's our federal elected officials and the public who needs to turn the screws on them. We need to demand that oil is transported in a safer way. But honestly, you know, my view is that the right answer here is that this born yesterday industry, which is playing Russian roulette with communities all across North America, needs to be stopped. And we need to say, no, we don't want your oil trains here at all. We don't want any of them. Because even the safest ones are not safe. And that's the solution, in my judgment.
Which steps being taken right now do you think are the most promising?
The most promising. There's a good piece of legislation in Olympia right now that it's in the House. There's a bad version of this legislation in the Senate. But the good version in the House, it doesn't answer every possible question, doesn't solve everything. But it makes some positive steps forward in making the oil industry have to bear financial responsibility for the risks it's inflicting. It provides some more cleanup and contingency planning of funds and some other mechanisms. That's a live question we have right now in Olympia. You know, I'd certainly encourage folks to contact their lawmakers and support that bill. But ultimately, again, it comes down to whether or not we're going to give the industry permission to build new oil train infrastructure in this region, because that's a decision we'll make in the next, it'll be 2015, 2016, maybe 2017. There are a very finite number of places where they can do this. We've seen their proposals. They're completely out of scale to anything we've seen in the past. If we say no, the problem goes away. So we should say no, and the problem will go away. That's a decision that will be left in some cases to Governor Inslee, in other cases to local communities. And it's something the public has every opportunity to really make a difference on in the near term.
Would you say more about what can be done to actually stop the new oil facilities?
So there are several different kinds, and of course, this is a conversation that gets complicated, and I've written about extensively for Sightline. So there's a refinery at Anacortes. The Shell refinery there is looking right now to build a new sort of a rail loop to allow oil trains to come on. That's a decision that's being contested right now in Skagit County. The really big questions are at Grays Harbor and on the Columbia River. And those projects are in the initial stages of permitting and review right now. Many of them will end up, at least one of them, the biggest one, will end up on Governor Inslee's desk. The others will end up in front of state and local jurisdictions. And when we get to a place where we're beginning to review those documents and the state is going to consider issuing permits for those, and that's happening really now, the public needs to be on record as vociferous opponents of those proposals, making clear that this is not something we want. It's bad for our economy. It's bad for our environment. It's inconsistent with who we are as a region. So the more that we can make our voices heard as saying, look, we don't want to double or triple the amount of oil we have in this region. We want to reduce it, not radically increase it. That will help our state agencies and state officials deny those permits, which is the right answer for the region.
How are the current economic forces affecting fossil fuel transport in the Northwest?
Yeah, you know, it's been really interesting to watch this. I mean, the history of energy price forecasting is the history of people being wrong over and over again. And so, you know, you can do this, you can say this coal, gas, oil. Forecasters have been wrong over and over again so often that I've stopped making predictions altogether, to be honest with you. in 2012, coal prices were spiking. And so we saw this, you know, half dozen or so coal export proposals. They've collapsed since then. None of those proposals, even if they were built now, would make a profit for those companies. They could go back up, who knows, but they look like they're down for the count. With oil, I think most people know that oil prices have crashed recently. Most forecasters expect those prices to stay low for the next couple of years, and then after that, the future gets more uncertain. Probably right now, what they do is they at least put a big question mark over the long-term viability of moving Canadian tar sands oil by pipeline and over lighter oils by rail. But we just don't know what the future holds. And because there are so many complexities in energy markets, and so much of it depends not just on the price, but on the price differential between domestic prices and foreign prices, there's just a huge swirl of uncertainty about whether they'll make money at all, and if they are going to make money, whether it's a little bit of money or whether it's epic amounts of money. The oil industry, as I think most folks are aware, does pretty well for itself. I mean, they're the most profitable corporations on the planet. So they stand to, in theory, make a lot of money from these proposals.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess what I want to say is that this is an issue that's not, it's not an environmental issue per se, because the oil industry, the Koch brothers and BP and Tesoro and the big players in these things are the primary funders of Tim Emmett initiatives, which is an anti-tax ballot initiative guru in Washington State. They fund, they have said that they're going to put in staggering quantities of money into the next presidential cycle. And they're funding very conservative, very anti-progressive policies across the spectrum. My contention is that even if you're not sort of quote-unquote environmentalist, but if you care about immigration reform, prison reform, race and social justice, women's issues, I don't care what it is, probably the biggest opponent that progressives have in general is money from the oil industry. It's money from the fossil fuel industry. And so to the extent that we value progressive politics, to the extent that we value not becoming a place that has its democracy corrupted and eroded, we need to make sure that the oil industry does not get a carte blanche permission slip to do what it likes, because when they take our money, they take it and put it to bad purpose.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Eric. Well,
thank you, Diane. I appreciate it.
You were just listening to Eric Duplass, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. For more information, check on the web at sightline.org. Again, that's sightline.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.